Welcome to the Verity Podcast for Wednesday, March 27th, 2024, where we separate the spin from the fact. I'm Scott Wallace.
And I'm Melissa Topshire with today's headlines. A Baltimore bridge collapses after a cargo ship crash.
RFK Jr. announces Nicole Shanahan as his running mate.
UK farmers protest in central London.
Fighting at Gaza City's Al-Shifa Hospital enters its second week.
The UK High Court delays its decision on Julian Assange's U.S. extradition.
A former Chinese soccer chief is jailed for bribery.
Japan agrees to sell fighter jets to 15 nations.
Bolsonaro is investigated for allegedly sleeping at the Hungarian embassy.
A former Trump DOJ official faces an ethics hearing.
A judge dismisses Elon Musk's lawsuit against the nonprofit.
And the Biden administration defends abortion pill access at the Supreme Court.
Our top story, a Baltimore bridge collapses after a cargo ship crash. The facts on this story are agreed upon by Fox 5 DC, WBAL, NBC 11 Baltimore, CNN, Reuters, and the Associated Press. The Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore collapsed into the Patapsco River early Tuesday morning after a 985-foot by 157-foot cargo ship crashed into one of the bridge's supports. Following the collapse, which occurred around 1:30 a.m. local time, several vehicles fell into the cold water. Fire Chief James Wallace said two people had been rescued, but between 7 and 20 were still missing in the water. Traffic was suspended at the Port of Baltimore, which is reportedly the busiest port for car shipments with over 750,000 in 2022. The Singapore-flagged ship, owned by Grace Ocean Private Limited and managed by Synergy Marine Corporation, reportedly lost propulsion as it was leaving the port. Danish firm Maersk, which serves over 100,000 businesses and carries over 12 million containers annually, was chartering the ship. Maersk is among the companies that have stopped traveling through the Suez Canal and Red Sea, having cut 10,000 jobs this year due to declining revenue. Maryland Governor Wes Moore said the incident points to an accident, and the FBI also said there's no specific and credible information to suggest terrorism. The National Transportation Safety Board launched a GO Team investigation into the matter. All lanes of Interstate 695 were closed at the bridge, with drivers being told not to use the highway's southeast corridor. Maryland Transportation Secretary Paul Wiedfeld said that while port traffic has been suspended, ground traffic can still pass through.
Thank you, Scott. On this show, we separate the facts from the narrative spins. We'll begin this round with a narrative A from Fox News. Infrastructure in parts of the U.S. has been neglected, and this can be the result of not putting money and ingenuity into preserving important roads and bridges. Other states should follow the lead of Florida, which has underwater structures to redirect ships that go off track and builds its bridges with redundancy, the ability to perform their function even when damaged. Neglected American infrastructure must be addressed.
And CBS brings us narrative B. Maybe the bridge could have been in better shape at the time of the incident, but the quality of the bridge isn't to blame for this incident. This should be a lesson that shipping traffic needs to be better managed and the size of cargo ships needs to be restricted. Even if this bridge had been rated better than fair, a classification most bridges in the U.S. have, it might not have been a match for this extra-large vessel.
And we have a nerd narrative from the Metaculous Prediction Community that says there's a 3% chance that an infrastructure disaster costing over $1 billion in a G20 country will be widely attributed to an AI cyber attack before January 1st, 2025. RFK Jr. announces Shanahan as his running mate. Here are the facts as agreed upon by the Associated Press, CNN, CBS, NBC, and KPRC Houston. Independent presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. announced on Tuesday that Nicole Shanahan, a California lawyer, will be his running mate. The 38-year-old attorney and philanthropist runs the Baya Echo Foundation and has never held elected office. Kennedy made his announcement at a rally in Oakland, California, and the move will help the independent ticket make progress in attaining ballot access. Nearly half of U.S. states require a vice presidential nominee before allowing a candidate on its ballot. RFK Jr., a former Democrat from the notorious Kennedy family, had floated several big names as potential running mates, including New York Jets quarterback Aaron Rodgers, former Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura, former U.S. Representative Tulsi Gabbard, and TV host Mike Rowe. However, RFK chose the wealthy tech magnate who already contributed millions of dollars to his campaign. Shanahan was involved in producing Kennedy's Super Bowl ad, and a group affiliated with her venture fund, Planeta Ventures, donated $4 million to his American Values 2024 Super PAC. Shanahan is an Oakland native from a disadvantaged background, and she went on to become one of Silicon Valley's most prominent lawyers and philanthropists. Her Baya Echo Foundation has worked extensively on issues such as reproductive longevity and criminal justice reform. She has frequently supported Democratic candidates in the past, and now that she is on the ticket, Shanahan can contribute an unlimited amount of money to help RFK's campaign, including the $15 million cost of attaining ballot access in all 50 states.
Thanks, Melissa. Newsweek brings us the establishment critical narrative. The Washington establishment, particularly those in the Democratic Party, is starting to sweat as RFK Jr. takes a major step in advancing his independent campaign. Kennedy's name recognition and populist platform have made him a unique threat. On top of that, with Nicole Shanahan in the fold, he now is a very wealthy running mate who can contribute an unrestricted amount to the campaign. In addition to her wealth, Shanahan has a history of supporting causes that voters care deeply about. And it will be hard for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris to match this energy and excitement.
Here's the pro-establishment narrative from Vox. While the media attention fixates on Joe Biden and Donald Trump, RFK Jr. remains a relative unknown compared to those two. This, along with his last name, may lead some people to believe that Kennedy is a benign and moderate figure. But this is not the case. For years, RFK Jr. has pushed dangerous anti-vaccine conspiracy theories and has even been disavowed by members of his own family. Luckily, RFK doesn't stand a reasonable chance of winning, and his pick of Nicole Shanahan will do very little to gather any steam for his campaign. Kennedy will try to play spoiler, but he won't get enough support to even make a meaningful difference in that role.
And the nerd narrative from Metaculus. There's a 25% chance that a third party or independent candidate will win at least 5% of the popular vote in the 2024 U.S. presidential election. Interesting point is that now this wealthy running mate, Shanahan, can donate an unlimited amount to the campaign. So I guess if you're running in the campaign, you're allowed to spend as much as you want. That's an interesting loophole.
Yeah, that kind of illuminates the process, huh? And makes you think, well, that's a pretty strategic pick, right? Pick someone who can just fund it for you.
To me, it always feels like the VP is just a chess move. We want this certain state, so we're going to choose this person, or this person's going to be a good debater, so they're going to win the VP debate or something. So why not just personal wealth being the...
I mean, if you don't have the GOP financing it or the Democratic ticket, with all this money, then so that's a smart move.
They tried to suffocate his campaign with money, and now they got all the money you need. Next up, UK farmers stage a tractor protest in central London. Here are the facts as agreed upon by BBC News, The Independent, Sky News, The Evening Standard, and The Financial Times. A go-slow farmer protest took place in London on Monday evening. More than 100 tractors gathered outside Parliament, demanding support for food production amid claims that cheap imports and the British farm payments scheme have placed food security at risk. Farmers allege that trade deals with New Zealand and Australia, the Asia-Pacific Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, or CPTPP, and a lack of import checks had undermined UK food quality and placed British farmers at risk. The organizations that staged the protest, Save British Farming and Kent Fairness for Farmers, also argued that British producers are now worse off than their EU counterparts who remain able to export EU-subsidized goods to the UK. This rally is the largest to have taken place in recent UK history, following a trend of similar protests in Europe, including France and Germany. According to official data, at least 3/5 of food consumed in Britain was grown in the country. The UK government has recently announced that, in order to maintain rates of food production, applications for post-Brexit farming subsidies will no longer be accepted if over 25% of farmland is used for environmental purposes.
Thank you, Scott, for those facts. Here's a left narrative from The Guardian. Brexiteers had pledged that the farming sector would be better off if the UK, which imports nearly half of its food and has traditionally neglected domestic production, left the EU. Unsurprisingly, the country is now on the brink of major food shortages due to a combination of border checks that brought confusion, ill-planned subsidies, and price pressure from retailers.
And we have a right narrative spin from The Telegraph, though post-Brexit agricultural policies do play a role in the current farming crisis. These are only minor factors within a much wider problem. Following farming protests in France and Germany, it was only a matter of time before British farmers escalated their demonstrations. Unsustainable high production costs, crop losses, and slow economic growth throughout Europe cannot be blamed solely on Brexit.
And there's another nerd narrative from Metaculus saying there's a 50% chance that the United Kingdom will apply to rejoin the EU by 2040. That would be a cool way to go to, like, tailgate to a Luke Combs concert. It's just everyone get in your tractor.
Oh,
come
yeah.
on down.
I mean, I love tractors. Kids, I mean, you can tell if something is objectively good if kids like it. And notice there's always like an old tractor somewhere for kids to play on. Like that's a big draw for little kids.
Oh, yeah. Let me see that machine and how it works.
And they can climb on it. They can do whatever. It doesn't seem all that safe, but everyone likes them so much. Even the most timid mother is fine with their kid climbing all over an old tractor for some reason.
It's quaint.
Yeah.
Fighting at Gaza City's Al-Shifa Hospital enters a second week. Here are the facts as agreed upon by NBC, Al Jazeera, and the Jerusalem Post. After launching an operation into Gaza City's Al-Shifa Hospital a week ago, heavy fighting is still reported in and around the complex, with the Israeli military saying it had killed over 170 Hamas militants. Videos from Al-Shifa and witnesses at the scene described widespread destruction and mass arrests. Israeli forces also reportedly encircled two hospitals in Khan Yunis on Monday, as the country's military has argued that Hamas uses hospitals and bases as command centers. The situation at Al-Shifa is still unclear. The last week of fighting has seen several accusations of war crimes, with Al Jazeera on Friday releasing footage taken from an Israeli drone, reportedly depicting four seemingly unarmed Palestinians being killed in a targeted strike as they tried to return to northern Gaza earlier in the war. Al Jazeera also released testimonies alleging Israeli forces conducted execution-style killings and abused people at Al-Shifa during the raid. However, Al Jazeera seemingly retracted an allegation that Israeli forces had raped Palestinian women at Al-Shifa, deleting the story from its site around 24 hours after the incident had been reported. Israel has repeatedly denied intentionally targeting civilians, with the military arguing that the drone footage was taken in an active combat zone that had already been evacuated. The military has asserted that militants hide among the civilian population to launch attacks against Israeli forces.
All right. Thanks, Melissa. We have a pro-establishment narrative on this divisive story from CBS News. The U.S. is doing everything it can to both ensure that Israel can eliminate Hamas's military capabilities and prevent regional escalation. Israel must be able to defend itself from terrorist attacks, whether from Gaza or elsewhere. And the U.S. will always support Israel in maintaining its security. However, Netanyahu is going too far with the war in Gaza, and he must be willing to follow through on his promises and compromise as needed so that another extended truce can take effect. Netanyahu must also understand that Israel only pushes Palestinians into Hamas's hands when it kills civilians.
And here's the pro-Israel narrative from the Jerusalem Post. Though the media and international agencies are more than happy to parrot Qatari-backed Hamas-adjacent propaganda, the truth is Israel is one of the few countries in the world to go as far as it does to ensure the safety of civilians. Of course, war is a tragedy that often creates situations in which individuals commit heinous acts. What makes Israel different, however, is that it actively investigates and holds accountable those who commit abuses. And the media should spend more time investigating Hamas's terrorist atrocities, to which Israel has been forced to respond.
Middle East Eye brings us the pro-Palestine narrative. The laundry list of Israel's crimes in Gaza grows by the day. Even if not every allegation is true, the course of the war and the sheer amount of condemning evidence clearly demonstrates a systemic policy of targeting Palestinian civilians. The international community is increasingly recognizing that Israel is guilty of the crime of genocide in Gaza, and it must be held accountable for such cruel acts.
And there's another nerd narrative from Metaculus saying there's a 67% chance that Israel will have de facto power in the Gaza Strip on January 1st, 2025.
The UK High Court delays its decision on Assange's U.S. extradition. Here are the facts as agreed upon by BBC News, the Associated Press, CBS, and the UK Royal Courts of Justice. The UK High Court has delayed a decision concerning whether WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange may be extradited to the US until May 20th, concluding that the journalist holds arguable grounds for appeal that require assurances from the US. Judge Dame Victoria Sharp and Justice Jeremy Johnson dismissed six of Assange's nine appeals but found Assange's claims that extradition was incompatible with Article 10 of the European Convention on Human Rights credible. Consequently, the court ruled that the U.S. must guarantee Assange, an Australian citizen, that he will be protected from the death penalty and that he will receive First Amendment rights. If these assurances are not made, the court stated it will grant Assange's appeal. The court's adjournment until May 20th is dependent on the U.S. providing its assurances by April 16th. Further written responses in response to the filing of such guarantees are allowed until April 30th and May 14th for Assange and the U.S. respectively. The judgment comes following a two-day hearing by the High Court's King's Bench Division in February. Assange is seeking permission to appeal a High Court Queen's Bench Division extradition ruling from December 2021, itself the product of a U.S. appeal to overturn a district court ruling 11 months prior. Assange's case concerns charges filed against him by the U.S. in 2019, including 19 counts of espionage and one count of computer intrusion, for obtaining and publishing material related to the national defense on WikiLeaks in 2010 with the help of former U.S. Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning.
Thank you, Scott. We'll start with an establishment critical narrative from Eurasia Review. Assange must be freed. The illegitimate attacks by the American state against the WikiLeaks founder for exposing the U.S.'s war crimes in Iraq are nothing short of disgraceful, constituting a level of persecution against whistleblowers previously unseen in American legal history. America is seeking to punish Assange for revealing the truth about their illegal military operations. Journalism and transparency must be protected at all costs.
And Washington Post brings us a pro-establishment narrative. Julian Assange is no journalist. Not only did he publish millions of stolen classified documents, he indirectly helped repressive regimes in Iran and China, as well as terror organizations such as Al-Qaeda, by disseminating that material. Such actions put U.S. soldiers and sources in extreme danger. The U.S. Department of Justice is correct to go after him.
And the nerds are at it again, this time with a 50% chance that Julian Assange will not be extradited to the U.S. after January 1st, 2025. News from the People's Republic of China, where a former soccer chief is sentenced for life for bribery. Here are the facts as agreed upon by Al Jazeera, BBC News, The Guardian, CNN, The Associated Press, and Business Mirror. Following one of the sport's most extensive anti-corruption investigations in years, Chen Shuwan, the former president of China's National Football Association, or CFA, was sentenced to life in prison on Tuesday, according to Xinhua News Agency. Chen pleaded guilty to corruption in January and admitted to taking bribes totaling 81 million yuan, or $11.2 million. Numerous coaches and players have been the subject of investigations as part of President Xi Jinping's ongoing anti-corruption campaign. Investigators discovered Chen had exploited his position with the CFA from 2010 until 2023. The court verdict stated that Chen caused tremendous damage to soccer in the PRC and that his illegal profits would be recovered and turned over to the state. Chen apologized to supporters and asked for forgiveness after Chen had admitted and repented his crime and cooperated with the inquiry, The court claimed it had shown clemency because China still uses the death sentence for corruption. Several well-known names in Chinese football were also sent to prison for corruption, including CFA Super League company CEO Dong Sheng, former high-ranking soccer official Chen Yonglang, and former National Athletics Association head Hong Shen. China's soccer leagues have long struggled with gambling gangs benefiting from payoffs to players and referees. Meanwhile, the PRC's men's and women's national teams have both struggled in international competitions.
Thanks, Melissa. We have a pro-China narrative on this story from Xinhua. As part of the Communist Party's plan to clean up sports by fighting corruption, a court has delivered a just sentence. Chen Shuan was given a life sentence for match fixing, taking bribes, and financial crimes. As part of Xi Jinping's goal to make China a football superpower by 2050, he plans to build thousands of new football fields and enroll kids in new football academies, as well as root out corruption.
Here's the anti-China narrative from DW. Xi Jinping's anti-corruption campaign is taking things too far. Life in prison and the death penalty for corruption are unusual punishment for white-collar crimes in the Western world, but not uncommon in China. Human rights organizations have long accused the Chinese government of using torture to extract alleged corruption confessions. For an issue like corruption in sports, this verdict was too strong.
And a nerd narrative from Metaculus. There's a 22% chance that China will lead the medal table at the Paris 2024 Summer Olympics.
Actually, $11.2 million. In soccer terms, that's not that much money.
It's actually not. Buying one bureaucrat is not that expensive in the grand scheme of things, which is why we're always buying off bureaucrats, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's even less to buy it. to corrupt a podcaster, I'm told.
Yeah, probably only like $1 million.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, there's two of us, so...
Well, okay, $2 million.
Japan to sell fighter jets to 15 nations. Here are the facts. As agreed upon by the Associated Press, Market Watch, Defense News, Independent, and BBC News. Japan Tuesday cleared the sale of next-generation fighter jets it has developed with Britain and Italy, a stark contrast from its long-held pacifist principles. Japan aims to bolster its role in the global security arena, especially amid regional tensions with China. Japan has restricted the exports of lethal weapons for the jets, pledging not to sell them for active warfare. Sales will also be limited to 15 countries that Japan has defense partnerships with. Tokyo last year cleared the transfer of radar to the Philippines and Patriot missiles to the U.S. It began developing the Mitsubishi FX fighter jet to replace aging aircraft by 2035. Japan has agreed to merge FX with a British-Italian program called the Tempest. The joint project, which aims to replace its old fleet of American F-2 jets and Eurofighter Typhoons, is known as the Global Combat Air Program. While Prime Minister Fumio Kishida has emphasized warplane exports to uphold Tokyo's credibility in international defense projects, Defense Minister Minoru Kihara has reaffirmed Japan's commitment to pacifist principles. After World War II, Japan adopted a constitution renouncing war and force for international conflict resolution. In 2014, then-Prime Minister Shinzo Abe relaxed the nation's arms export ban for the first time.
Those were the facts. Here are the spins, starting with an anti-China narrative from The Independent. The sale of future fighter jets to other nations is part of Japan's strategy to not limit itself to a supporting role in global defense projects. The move comes amid neighboring China's emergence as an aggressive military power, which concerns Tokyo given the many disputes it has with Beijing in the East and South China Seas. China's frequent war games with Russia around Japan haven't soothed nerves either.
And the pro-China narrative from the Global Times. Japan has already broken from its decades-long principle of pacifism, but that's not all Tokyo wants to do. By loosening its lethal weapon export rules on top of expanding its military partnership with the U.S., Kishida's government is slowly working its way toward terminating Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution, which prohibits the military from engaging in warfare. Given Japan's history of aggression, the entire region will be on high alert, not just China.
Here's the cynical narrative from Forbes. Japan's increasing interest in military affairs will be complex from any perspective. Japan's military posturing through alliances and its existing offensive capabilities always had Beijing on the radar. While China is currently focused on increasing economic pressures, it will now be forced to redirect resources and shift its focus away from its financial issues. Tokyo's change symbolizes the increasing challenges of navigating the multipolar world.
And the nerd narrative from Attaculous, there's a 51% chance that Japan will respond with military force if China invades Taiwan before 2035.
Brazil's federal police launched an investigation into Jair Bolsonaro on Monday in the wake of a report from the New York Times that he spent two nights at the Hungarian embassy in Brasilia last month, just days after having his passport seized. Additionally, Supreme Court Justice Alexandra de Moraes ordered Bolsonaro to explain his extended embassy stay. If Brazilian authorities had sought to arrest him when he was inside a foreign embassy, he would have been legally off limits to them. This comes as the Times had access to 3 days of footage from security cameras showing the arrival of Bolsonaro late on February 12th and his departure in the afternoon of February 14th. According to satellite imagery, the car in which he arrived was parked in the driveway on February 13th. Bolsonaro, who enjoys a close relationship with Hungary's Viktor Orbán, told local news outlet Metropolis that he has a circle of friends with heads of state around the world and that the rest is speculation. Summoned by the Brazilian Foreign Ministry to explain why Bolsonaro spent two nights at the embassy, the Hungarian ambassador reportedly remained silent during his meeting with Brazilian diplomats on Monday. While investigators claim it's too early to say if the stay at the embassy was an attempt to flee, aides to the Lula administration said that his visit has been interpreted as an interference in Brazil's internal affairs.
Thanks, Melissa. Daily Kos brings us a left narrative. As legal challenges against him mount, it's anything but surprising that Bolsonaro would hide and seek asylum at the Hungarian embassy. He has long been close friends with his fellow far-right compatriot Orbán, a relationship that prompted Budapest to offer assistance to get him reelected. And this wouldn't be unprecedented, as Bolsonaro ran away to America to skip Lula's inauguration before.
And here's the right narrative from the Gateway Pundit. Given that the Times broke this story shortly after CIA Director William Burns traveled to Brazil, it's hard to believe that this political thriller isn't part of deliberate efforts by the Biden administration to damage the reputations of conservative champions Bolsonaro and Orbán. Even Brazilian justices who have persecuted the former president know that these latest allegations would be too much.
And the nerd narrative from Metaculus, there's a 60% chance that any member country will leave BRICS before 2035. Former Trump DOJ official Clark faces an ethics hearing. Here are the facts, as agreed upon by Reuters, Raw Story, and the Washington Examiner. Jeffrey Clark, who was a senior Department of Justice official during former President Trump's term, Tuesday faced a disciplinary hearing by the District of Columbia Bar over his alleged attempts to enlist the DOJ in overturning the 2020 presidential election. During the hearing of a three-member panel of the Board of Professional Responsibility, lead investigator Hamilton Fox said Clark's actions following the 2020 election amounted to a coup attempt. The Ethics Board is part of the D.C. Court of Appeals, which could decide to revoke or suspend Clark's legal license. Clark's defense attorney, Harry McDougall, denied the accusations, arguing that Clark was involved in internal debate and disagreement within the DOJ over voter fraud. Clark, who is also one of the defendants in Trump's Georgia election interference case, is accused of making false statements in a letter he sent to the then acting attorney general regarding the election. Several of the former president's allies and officials from his administration are expected to testify in the hearing, including former chief of staff Mark Meadows and Republican representatives Matt Gaetz of Florida and Scott Perry of Pennsylvania.
We'll begin this round of spins with an anti-Trump narrative from the Washington Post. In his official capacity, Clark chose to back Trump's lies over the Constitution and the will of the people. For someone who attempted a coup, disbarment is the least he deserves, and the Georgia case just might bring him more punishment. It's paramount that those who took part in Trump's attempted coup face the music while he seeks another presidential term.
And Human Events brings us the pro-Trump narrative. Clark is only guilty of exercising his First Amendment right to question the election results. Since then, he's had his name dragged through the mud by the House committee investigating the January 6, 2021 riots at the Capitol and faced criminal charges in Georgia. Now he's facing this kangaroo court trying to disbar him. This witch hunt against Trump and everyone associated with him has to stop.
And we have another nerd narrative from Metaculous saying there's a 17% chance that any state will refuse to certify the results of the 2024 presidential election. A judge dismisses Musk's suit against a nonprofit. Here are the facts as agreed upon by New York Times, The Verge, News at X News, Counterhate, and NPR Online News. Elon Musk-owned X, formerly Twitter, lawsuit against the Center for Countering Digital Hate, or CCDH, a nonprofit studying online hate speech, Monday was dismissed by a federal judge who ruled the suit was an attempt to silence a group that was speaking negatively about the platform. X filed the suit in California in July 2023 after the CCDH published several articles claiming Musk's takeover of X was followed by an increase of hate speech on the platform. In his decision, federal judge Charles Breyer denied X's claims that the CCDH had violated the platform's terms of service by unlawfully scrapping its data. Breyer also ruled that CCDH's actions did not amount to a breach of contract or a violation of any law. In a post on X, the platform said it disagrees with the judge's ruling and plans to appeal. In a statement posted to the CCDH website, Imran Ahmed, chief executive officer and founder, said the CCDH hopes this landmark ruling will inspire researchers to continue working to hold social media platforms accountable for the hate and disinformation they often host. Musk is currently involved in a separate suit he filed in November against the nonprofit Media Matters for America, which he accuses of a smear campaign over its reports that advertisements were appearing on X next to anti-Semitic content.
Thanks, Melissa. Narrative A on this story comes from The Guardian. This suit and others like it are Musk's attempt to leverage his immense wealth to silence critics, despite his claims of being a free speech absolutist. Throwing out this nuisance lawsuit was the best way for the courts to discourage Musk from continuing to pursue legal action to squelch free speech and empower organizations like the CCDH to continue their work without fear of legal repercussions.
Here's a narrative B from the National Review. Legal action is the only way for Musk to fight back against advocacy groups that disagree with the content on X. These groups attack the platform by telling advertisers lies about the content and then threaten those companies into pulling their money. Those groups are the true opponents of free speech, and Musk has no choice but to sue them for putting the financial future of X in peril.
And a nerd narrative from Metaculous, there's a 10% chance that Elon Musk will become the world's first trillionaire. The Supreme Court hears the Mifepristone appeal. Here are the facts as agreed upon by The Hill, CBS, NBC, and Reuters. The U.S. Supreme Court on Tuesday heard arguments regarding President Joe Biden's administration appeal of a lower court ruling that limited access to an abortion pill known as Mifepristone. This is the first time the issue of abortion has come before the Supreme Court since the justices overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022. A federal appeals court previously sided with anti-abortion doctors and medical groups after they challenged changes the Food and Drug Administration made to make mifepristone more available in 2016 and 2021. On Tuesday, the justices focused on whether the plaintiffs have standing in the case, questioning whether the doctors who are objecting to prescribing it are being injured. A ruling is expected by June, but regardless of the Supreme Court's decision, litigation on this issue is expected to continue.
Here's the left narrative spin from MSNBC. It's absurd that physicians who have a right under federal law to refrain from performing abortions are asking the government to restrict any and all access to mifepristone. These medical professionals are not being injured, so they have no standing. If SCOTUS rules otherwise, it'll be another sign of how little the extreme right justices value the freedoms bestowed by the Constitution.
And the right narrative spin comes from Daily Wire. Medical professionals have standing to sue the FDA on behalf of the unborn children who won't get to live if the FDA is permitted to make mifepristone so widely available. The FDA's weakened safeguards will also put women's health at risk and put doctors in precarious positions when forced to treat mothers who take mifepristone without professional guidance.
And here's the final nerd narrative from Metaculus. It says there's a 3% chance that elective abortion will be banned nationally in the U.S. before January 1st, 2030. Thank you for listening to the Verity Podcast for Wednesday, March 27, 2024.
Each day, we use machine learning to read about 5,000 articles from about 100 newspapers to figure out which ones are about the same stories. For each major story, our editorial team then extracts both the key facts that all articles agree on and the key narratives where the articles differ.
For more information on Verity, you can visit our website, verity.news, or download our app on the Apple App Store or Google Play. For Scott Wallace, I'm Melissa Topshire, inviting you to join us next time on Verity.